Do what you love because people are going to criticize you anyways.
You're stepping into the ring with two guys who pull no punches. This is Entrepreneur Showdown.
Happy, happy, happy Monday morning, everybody. It is Entrepreneur Showdown time. I am your congenital host, Dan Franks, and my partner in crime, the other congenital host, Joe Cassandra. He's coming on in a bit. And if you missed us last week, we missed you. Thanks for welcoming us back. Thanks for accepting us with all our faults of missing our first week ever since we started. And I'm not going to delve too much into that because I confront Joe about our issues missing a week in round one. And then, of course, we have a main event hard-hitting interview with a special guest, Ryan Avery. He is the world champion of public speaking. If you didn't know that existed, you do now. He's awesome. We're going to have a great talk with him in the main event, but we won't pull our punches. We never do. And, of course, if you want to check out all our past hard-hitting episodes and a whole lot more about Joe and myself, you can head on over to EntrepreneurShowdown.com. And if you have a chance, visit ShowdownLove.com. Leave us a review. Let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you. But with all that out of the way, let's get on to round one and let's get on with the showdown.
Round one.
For round one today, Joe and I are talking about an article by Ramit Sethi, who I've had his book for a long time, read it multiple times. I Will Teach You to Be Rich and I Will Teach You to Be Rich.com. And he's kind of known as a, you know, cut through the crap kind of guy. He's not afraid to talk about what's on his mind or what he's seeing going on in his community or communities around him. And Joe, you suggested this article for round one, and I think it's pretty interesting because it's about how to conquer self-sabotage and how to get rid of the excuses or maybe look past the excuses and things like that. So I just want to first of all start with an explanation for our excuse for why this show is a week later and there was no show last week. So what is our excuse before we dive into what Ramit has to say about excuses?
Well,
I mean, do we have a good one? Because I think the answer would be
probably
no.
Not. We had to work a lot at work because I worked a lot and you worked a lot, but at the same time, we've managed to work a lot before and find time.
So, I mean, is there a root to this? Is it just a matter of,
I think it was, I don't know. Usually we have Fridays and we're able to nail it down, or Saturday, and it just didn't happen.
So, I mean, it was just like a perfect storm. You know, like, because usually, like you said, between Thursday or Friday, or sometimes we push it all the way to Saturday, you know, Saturday, sometimes midnight going into Sunday. But we always, you know, for the past, whatever, 50 episodes have managed to get it done and, you know, put out what we consider quality. And we just weren't able to. So maybe, you know, maybe it was just a perfect storm. I don't think we have any good reason. So anything we would come up with would just be an excuse. So that's why I found it kind of ironic that this was the article we picked out, but in a good way, because, you know, we just decided that probably there is no good excuse. And I think that's what Ramit's article here is talking about a lot is, yeah, there's plenty of excuses, but chances are most of them are not good. And he gives a lot of examples about, you know, if you're reading a website looking for some advice and 99% of that article resonates with you, but maybe whatever its core meaning is, you just don't really want that to, you know, prevail in your mind. You're going to pick out the 1% that you don't agree with, and that's what you're going to put all of your focus on, and that's why you're not going to take that advice. And, you know, I totally have done that kind of thing before. You read through a full article, and then you're like, maybe looking at, you know, something one of the commenters said down below, and you're like, oh, yeah, that guy has a good point. I no longer agree with this article, or I no longer am going to do that. Or it could be anything, but have you kind of had this 99.1% experience where that 1% prevailed?
Yes, definitely. Because, well, as humans, we're naturally go towards what's easier. And so when you see something and you're like, yeah, I should do that, you're automatically in your head looking for a reason why you shouldn't have to do that, because it's just easier for you not to have to do that. So, like a lot of people, when they struggle with just starting any type of side hobby or business or whatever, they always think, okay, well, what if I don't have an idea? And then you read about a story about, oh, well, I grew up loving whatever, cars, and so I started a car wash or something. And you think, oh, well, I didn't grow up liking anything, so that can't be, that maybe it's just not for me. And so you're automatically looking for reasons to get out of whatever you feel responsible for, your responsibility for, which it could be anything. I mean, it's, I do it all the time too, so I'm not preaching to anyone. I'm preaching to myself pretty much.
Yeah, and I think it's a matter of being proactive and not reactive is the best way I can describe it. Just reading through some of these points that Ramit makes, he says he gets a lot of emails of people asking, well, what if I don't have a good idea, or what if I don't have this amount of time, you know, to put into something, or what if I don't have, you know, what if I don't live in the right location to do this work? And a lot of that's reactive, like you're kind of reading something and then you're saying, yeah, but I, you know, finding ways to disagree with an article, as opposed to almost going out proactive. So if you're reading an article and you're like, oh, this is great if I had an idea, but I don't. Well, instead of doing that, why don't you out in the real world be more conscious of what's going on around you and find the ideas, you know, be consciously looking for ideas. Or instead of saying, well, I can't do this because I don't have 10 hours a week. Well, why not be conscious of what you do on a daily basis and pick out an hour a day, and maybe you can come up with 5 or 6 hours a week that you're wasting somewhere else. So I think a lot of this excuses is just being reactive instead of proactive.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to where you want to do what's easiest for you, and it's usually you take the path of least resistance, which is usually to do nothing. And so if you can find a way to justify that in your head, it makes you feel less guilty about not completing that task. And so maybe that's why you go and read some of the comments, because you're looking for that one comment that'll ease your guilt in any which way. Because I mean, we all read all these sites. Like, I love reading Ramit's stuff, but I haven't implemented all his stuff, and that's probably because of the same reason. I'll read something and then he'll be like, hey, check out this case study, and I'll listen. And I say case study because this article, if you sign up for his email list, which you definitely should do, I highly recommend it. We don't get anything for saying that. You can get a case study for his new course that's coming up. But in those cases, you listen to or read the testimonial, and they'll have this different circumstance than you. And so you're automatically justifying in your head that, oh, well, they have that circumstance, so that's why they could do that, but I could never do something like that. And so you're always looking for a way to justify it. How do you avoid doing that? I don't know. I don't have an answer to doing that. I don't know.
Well, people have always told me that I'm too analytical, or I, you know, ask too many questions. But sometimes in a situation like this, you know, coming up against a bunch of excuses, I find that me asking questions is the best way to kind of conquer those excuses. So similar to how I started out this chat, you know, why didn't we? Why not? Well, every time I come up to an excuse, I try to ask myself that question, why not? So if it is, I don't have an idea. Well, why don't I have an idea? Am I not being observant of the world around me enough? Am I, you know, just, do I have ideas? I'm just not, you know, vetting them. Or what if I don't have 10 hours a week? And goes back to it, and I'm kind of repeating it here, but why don't I have 10 extra hours a week to work on something? Well, it's probably because I'm, you know, sitting on my phone looking through Facebook or Snapchat or whatever the crap people are doing now, or I'm playing Flappy Birds, or, you know, I'm watching too much Real World on Netflix. All of those things I do, and all of those things I could, you know, get more time out of. So I feel like, to me, and you said you don't know, you might not know any techniques. That's my technique for getting through these excuses. Just ask yourself a question. Just keep asking why, like the little annoying kid that I used to be when people would say, oh, you can't do that. Why not? And you keep asking that, saying that just to get on people's nerves. But in reality, if you start asking yourself those questions when you come up to these excuses, I think that's a good way to break down the barriers, because in reality, you're going to figure out maybe you don't have as many good reasons as you thought you did for not doing something. But that's a little excuse talk. We're going to link you over to Ramit's website. If you don't know Ramit, you've got to go check him out and spend a couple days reading through all his content. Buy his book, figure out some good financial life hacks that can make your financial life a little better, and find out what song he found on Pandora and went and downloaded at this article as well. Ramit is not afraid to speak his mind, and if you're an aspiring blogger, he might just be a good person to model. He's got a very unique writing style. He's not afraid to be himself and you know, call a spade, so I feel like when I'm reading this, it kind of encourages me that there might be some people writing some different types of blogs out there that you can check out and learn a few things from, and maybe, you know, a breath of fresh air. But that is all the time for round one. Now let's get on to round two.
Round two.
For round two today, we're talking about an article by Ryan Avery. And Ryan Avery will be on with us in the main event. He is a top-notch speaker, so you won't want to miss that. One of his most popular posts has hundreds of shares on Facebook. He had lunch with a billionaire. Billionaire
with a B.
Billionaire Club. Red McCombs. I've never heard of him, but hey, he's got the billionaire status.
So he's a Texan. You got to know that first.
He is a Texan. I did. I looked him up, and I did see he was in Houston. He's from Houston, Texas. But I hadn't heard of him prior to this.
So he just a quick background on old Red here. He is a big automotive guy in Texas, owns a big group of auto dealerships. He's owned some sports teams. He was co-founder of Clear Channel. So he's pretty much been in every single niche you can imagine, it seems like.
So as a Texan, because I'm a new Texan, you're a born Texan, you already knew him and whatnot. Is that right?
Yeah, I did. And I didn't know that he actually ventured out into some of these other industries. I know that UT Austin, the business school is named after him, so he's pretty much a legend in Texas business scene.
Those Texans, they'll get you. But Ryan, he got to have lunch with Red, which, I mean, I'm sure it's a huge honor. He doesn't share how he got to that meeting. Maybe he'll share with us, because I'm sure that's an interesting story. But he pulled away some points from the lunch, because, I mean, whenever you meet a millionaire, billionaire, you want to... I mean, you kind of want to know a little bit of the secret. Hey, how do you really get to where you are? What's the secret that you never hear? And he pulled five lessons from Red. And we're just going to go over a couple of them right now. You'll have to go check out the article to read them all. But one that stuck out to me, and it always sticks out to me, is only focusing on one thing at a time. And this is a tip from Red. He says, hey, if you're in a meeting, focus on a meeting. If you're at lunch with someone, focus on that lunch with that person. And me, because we talked about in a previous episode how we did, like, Colby, learn about your nature and everything. And my big thing is I'm futuristic. So I'm always looking ahead. I'm not living in the present. So this is a hard thing for me, because I want to try and do 50 million things at once. So, and it's tough to do that. And you always half-ass at least one of them.
Well, and I always wonder, when you hear these things like only focus on one thing, is that talking about one big project you should be focused on at all times, or you should be focused on whatever that specific task you're working on, but it's okay to have different tasks later on that work on different projects? And I think that might be arguing semantics a little bit, but I'd like to know kind of what Ryan's thought and maybe what he interpreted Red to mean. Because Red, we just talked about, he owned professional sports teams. He ran large auto dealership groups. He co-founded Clear Channel. All these things that are completely, I would say, at least, you know, from the finished product standpoint, unrelated. But he was able to have his hand in all these different things. And surely some of these were happening simultaneously. So I think it's interesting to hear these people say, you know, focus on one thing at a time. But then they're successfully doing multiple things. So maybe it's a matter of building systems, so then you can kind of put them on autopilot or tune out a little bit. I don't know how you interpreted that.
Again, it's hard for me because I like to...
Because you're futuristic. Okay.
Yes. Well. And I like to do multiple things at once because I want to be good at multiple things at once. But then I always run into the problem of, okay, if I'm working on this thing, how do I know when to just stop doing that, because maybe it's not going to be successful, or maybe I'm just not good at it, and I shouldn't keep going along that path, working on that, and move on to something else. And that's probably why I like to juggle different things, because I'm I guess I'm never going to reach that point because I always have something else to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know what you mean. But you know that, like you said, you're futuristic. I'm a little not, so I'll give you the benefit of the doubt.
You live in the present. Is that what it is?
You know, I don't know. I obviously look to the future, but I think I am. It is a little easier for me to focus on, you know, specific tasks. Now, maybe big picture, I'm focusing on multiple things at once, and that is probably where the root of my interest comes in. What specifically this means, only focus on one thing at a time, because big picture, I like to have multiple things that I'm working on. But I think in terms of, hey, this is my task for right now, I'm able to focus on that. All right.
Oh, well, let's get on to another one because we talked about that one. And another one he talks about is the second one on the list, which is the best time is now, meaning you're going to make a lot of excuses for why you shouldn't start something right now because it's busy at work, or your wife's having a baby, or something like that. Or like my wife and I, we just bought a house. We got to settle in first before that. And Red is basically saying, hey, the best time to start is right now. And we're going to hear this from Ryan as well, because he has a cool story, because he won the world champion of public speaking, and he set a goal, and he had it on video too. And he just started right then saying, okay, I want to be the world champion of public speaking. And 10 months later or whatever, he was the world champion. And he didn't wait around for every little piece to be in place. He just started it right there. And that'll be something cool to talk about.
That was one of his practices. You mentioned him shooting the video that says, hey, I'm going to do this. And then later on, he followed through with that commitment. And that's one of his three P's that he talks about that I know we'll get into. But one of them is one of the keys is to hold yourself accountable. And if you get on camera or talk to somebody or do something that commits yourself to some kind of act or some kind of direction you're taking yourself, you have that accountability. And we've talked about accountability quite a bit in the last few weeks. And it's interesting that it's come up a lot more lately, but it just seems like these are some of the discussions we've been having. But he has these practices to make himself more accountable. And we'll get into that with him. But speaking on the best time is now, I always think it's interesting when people come out and say, it's not about picking the right thing. It's about picking something and then doing it and then doing that thing right. So you don't have to pick the right thing right out of the gate. Whatever you do pick, you have to do it right. And that's an interesting balancing act and an interesting concept and a little hard to wrap your head around. So maybe Ryan, being the world champion public speaker, he can kind of verbalize that a little better and explain it to us.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to have a lot to talk about with Ryan. So let's get to Ryan Avery in the main event.
It's time for the main event.
For the main event today, we have Ryan Avery, the youngest world champion of public speaking. You'll find him at howtobeaspeaker.com. He has a new book coming out and a book tour next month, and he'll be coming to Dallas, Texas. And his wife, Chelsea, and him pee three times a day. That's right, they pee three times a day. Ryan, thanks for coming on. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, well, before we dive in, can you explain the three P's to our listeners before they think we're actually talking about the real P?
Yes, I know. Some people are like, hey, man, you don't know me that well. So what Chelsea and I do, Chelsea is my wife and business manager, so she is the boss at home and at work. We work together, and in order to accomplish big goals that we set, we pee three times a day. And those three P's are: we prioritize, we publicize, and we practice. So we set a priority of what it is that we want to accomplish. We publicize, we let every single person that we know what it is that we want to do, and then we practice within that category. We do that over and over and over again every single day, and eventually we reach our big goals with that formula.
What's an example of that? If are you setting like a big goal and then you're telling everyone, okay, here's the little things we're doing to get to that goal?
Yeah, that's good. So I use it to win the world championship. My recent one right now is to break the world record for the largest book signing in history. So right now my priority, it says break the world record for largest book signing in history. And then I have to publicize that. So I have to tell my friends, my family, I have to let people who, strangers, anywhere and everywhere that I can, know that that's what I'm trying to do. And in order to make that goal a reality, I have to practice. So I put a training schedule together. I have to sign 5,000 signatures in 11 hours. So I'm practicing signing books, and I'm practicing doing different types of push-ups. I'm practicing standing for 6-7 hours a day. I'm practicing smiling for that long. I'm trying to get everything down so when the day comes, I can knock out 5,000 signatures in 11 hours and break the world record for the largest book signing in history. What I tell people, so most people don't even have goals, and then if they do, what they forget is they forget to tell the people around them what it is that they're trying to accomplish. And 95% of the time, people want to help you get to where you want to go. They just don't know what it is that you're trying to do. And the best analogy I can use is, think about someone in your hometown, Dallas, Texas. What's up? My Texas pride's there. I'm from Houston. What? So they're standing in Dallas and you're walking by them and they have this huge map out in front of them and they looked confused. How many people who are listening right now, even you two, would go up and help that person get to where they want to go, right?
I know Joe would. If you haven't noticed, Joe's the extravagant type.
Okay, so you would help them, right? That's the exact same thing with publicizing your goals. You need to put your map out in front of you, and you need to say, hey, I'm lost. I know where I want to go. I just don't know how to get there. Who can help me? So publicize it, put it out there, and you would be amazed by how many people will help you.
Okay. I mean, this kind of ties into the article we're going to look at, which is Lunch with a Billionaire. But before we jump into that, which we're about to jump right back into it, because we like to skip intros and backstories because we rather send people somewhere else to one of our friends to hear that. Have you been on a recent podcast that tells your story really well?
I would recommend, just for anyone, to go to Starve the Doubts with Jared Easley. He has a good one about me, plus he's a great podcaster, and I think he does a really good job of talking about my story. So it's Starve the Doubts with Jared Easley. I'd highly recommend that one.
Hey Joe, I gotta cut in here. Is that back-to-back weeks for Jared?
That
here
is back-to-back. We have our guest recommending Jared's podcast. We love you, Jared. Okay, because I want to dive more into, because you say a lot of people don't have goals, which is kind of polarizing, because a lot of people would argue against that, even though they just say, oh, well, I just don't tell people about them because it's not anyone's business. But you have your article, Lunch with a Billionaire, which I'm going to ask you how you met him later. We're not going to do that right now. But since we're talking about goals, one that I struggle with is the fourth one, when we talked about this in round two, only focus on one thing at a time. And for me, I feel like, okay, I want to do all these different things, so I don't really need a goal. I just want to get better at all these different things. But I mean, Red's saying, and I'm sure you're saying the same thing, is no, you got to focus on one and set a goal in whatever that one thing, just like you did with winning the World Championship of Speaking. Focus on that one thing and forget about the rest of it and just get really good at that. Is that kind of what you're thinking your philosophy is?
100%. And going back to what you were saying about you not thinking a lot of people have goals, I bet you if you walked up and asked people what goals they had for this year or what they have for their life, you would be amazed by how many people who would just not be able to give you answers. They know they want to do something, they just don't know the specifics of it. And that's the important part, is knowing what specific thing it is that you want to accomplish. So my thing is, I have a lot of passions, right? I like to travel, I like to write, I enjoy going scuba diving, I like to do all those things, I like to speak. But I have to understand that one of my passions will let all of my other passions live professionally. So professionally, I have chosen to speak to let all my other passions live. I do anything and everything I can. I watch TED Talks every day. I read books. I attend seminars all around improving your communication skills. So I am learning how to effectively be able to teach and train and speak on the area of communication. That is my one subject, my one goal. I recommend having one thing. It goes back to P3 times a day, right? Prioritize. What is the one thing that you need to do to let all of your other goals and passions live? So for me, right, this my priority, if I focus on this one goal of breaking this world record, I will sell 5,000 books, I'll become a New York Times bestseller, I'll break a world record, I'll help raise money for for Colorado State University students. I'll encourage people to dream big and go after their goals. So it opens so many more doors if you just focus on one rather than being spread so thin.
Wait, that sounded like a bunch of goals. That didn't sound like one goal. That sounded like a lot of goals.
Oh, no. I'm saying the outcome of what the world record gets me are those things. So that's not my goal. Those are the outcomes. The goal is to break the world record for the largest book signing in history. What that does is it opens up other doors, right? So you become a New York Times bestseller, you raise money because all of the proceeds and profits from that event will go to support Colorado State University scholarship funds. So it helps do so much more. Does that make sense?
So, okay, because those all still sound like goals to me. So how does someone figure out, okay, this is going to be my one goal and this will be all the outcomes, instead of saying, okay, I need to focus on this goal, this goal, this goal? You're saying focus on one goal that all these outcomes are going to happen because you reach that one goal. Is that right?
Yes, definitely. So one of my goals was to win the World Championship of Public Speaking. My goal at that time wasn't to write a book and to go travel all over the world and coach different people, but those were the outcomes that happened once I won. It helped me write a book. It helped me travel the world. It helped me train and coach business executives and college students. It opened up a lot of doors because I focused on that one. For example, if I was trying to learn how to write a book and learn how to be a better speaker and go out and learn my coaching and training, I would be spread too thin and I wouldn't be able to do that.
What kind of metric do you use to figure out what level your goal needs to be set at? And then, you know, as opposed to trying to figure out what that end game is, because this is something Joe and I talked about in round two before we brought you on, was I always struggle with, well, I want to set these goals, but do they need to be small task type goals? Like, hey, within the next week, I need to do this week, I need to do that, because those goals are more attainable. Or do they need to be big picture, or do they need to be medium picture? How do you determine what that goal needs to be and not confuse them like Joe did with, you know, After Effects?
That's a great question. And I can only speak on behalf of me, but my
Well, you are the featured guest, so we'd like to hear your answer. Yes.
My rule is dream big, start small. So for me, I don't want to be good. I don't want to be great. I want to be the best in the category that I'm in. And I think everyone should focus on that. Life is way too short. You're giving so many opportunities. You have so many great things within you that don't focus on being good. Don't focus on being great. Go for being the best in that category. So for me, when I pick a goal, I don't pick something that everyone else is doing. I pick something that no one has ever done before. I want to win an Emmy when I'm 20. I won an Emmy when I was 23. I want to break a world record when I'm 26. I want to be the youngest world champion of public speaking. I want to do those things and have the best opportunity. I think anyone and everyone can have that, but you have to change that mindset into thinking, okay, I don't need to just be good. I don't need to be great. I want to hold myself to the higher standard and be the best at whatever it is I'm doing.
There's these thoughts that you, I'm sure, don't let creep into your head, but these doubts, what happens if I don't reach this goal? Then, you know, if your goal, for instance, is to break this world record, well, what if you don't break it? Are you a failure? Are you worse off than when you started? How do you handle that kind of thing?
That's a great question. And I live my life, I don't have a plan B. I only have a plan A. Too many people are on the fence. And for me, you have to be all in. You got to jump in the deep end in order to learn how to swim. And once you learn how to swim, you can go to any pool you want. For me, this is a good example. Last year, I applied to go get my master's at Columbia. That was my goal. I was the first person to graduate in my family. I never read a book until I was in college. I just never understood and appreciated academics until I went to Colorado State University, and I got a 980 on my SATs when I was in high school, combined score, may I add. I was not that kid. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to prove to myself that I could get into an Ivy League school. I could do this. I could learn from the best. It was the best program in the world, hands down, and I didn't get in. And I was devastated. I was like, man, this was my goal. This is what I wanted to do. Well, I then, after that, decided to go on a 50-city North American tour, where I put together a tour that hit, obviously, 50 cities in North America to teach people how to be a better speaker. What that did is it, in turn, helped me reach thousands of people, build my contact list, grow as a speaker, as a leader, as a human. And I contacted Columbia afterwards, after this tour, told them about it, and now they're interested and they want me to apply again. So yes, my plan A didn't happen right then, but my plan A was go to Columbia, didn't happen then, opened up other doors, and then it then in turn said, okay, now you've got some more credentials, we're interested in you applying again.
So is that when you start walking away slowly, flipping them the bird? Yeah.
No, I want to go to Columbia. I honestly, they have the best program in the world. It just wasn't that time for me. So I didn't see it as a failure. I just saw it as, okay, this wasn't the right time for me. I still want to go to this. People, they quit too soon. They stop or they see obstacles. I cannot tell you how many obstacles, how many doors have been shut on trying to break this world record. But there have been doors that have opened, and you just can't let one door stop you, because there are so many things that are there that you can take advantage of.
Well, one thing that I know at least I struggle with is, because someone always tells me, and I hear it all the time, hey, just focus on one thing, stop focusing on a bunch of things. And I feel like, okay, if I'm focusing on this one thing, how do I know when, hey, there is a roadblock? How do I know that maybe that's a sign that I'm just not good at that and I need to move on to something else? Or maybe that's not what I'm supposed to do. How do you figure that out? Or are you just one of those that you just plow right through until forever? Amen.
I pick something that I'm passionate about. So I believe your voice is the most powerful tool on the planet. Hands down, I'll debate that with you till whenever we can. Your voice is the most powerful tool on the planet. So I pick things that I'm passionate about. I'm passionate about making sure people learn how to speak better and help them understand that education is important. So those are the goals that I pick, right? So that falls in line with this world record that I'm trying to break. So for me, if I'm going after my passion, I can't pick the wrong thing. Those are doors that I gotta blow through.
Is there something you're passionate about right now that you're not currently pursuing?
Ooh, that's a good question. I would say no. I am doing something right now. So for me, I've identified what I need to feel successful. So success to me is not a destination, it's a feeling. And right now I am doing what I love. I'm spending time with who I love. My wife, I get to spend time with her 24/7, which some couples would be like, that's crazy. But I love
it. We would never say that.
So for me right now, no, I'm getting to live my passion. I'm getting to teach people to use their voice to make a difference. I'm helping leaders communicate. I get to travel all over the world and spend time with the one person on this planet that I love the most. So for me, I'm good. I have a lot of work to do. And sometimes I want to pull out my hair and throw something through the wall. But that doesn't mean I'm not going towards something that I'm passionate about.
So out of all the passions in the world that you love, you're pursuing all of them right now. That's what you're saying.
Oh, wow. That sounds...
It's the same question, just a little hard.
Yeah, I mean, my book is coming out in April. I'm writing. I'm traveling. I get to scuba dive. I get to speak and use my voice. I am teaching, which is the thing that I love to do, and that's one of my biggest passions. So yeah, I'm speaking, I'm writing, I'm teaching, I'm spending time with my wife, and I'm traveling, and I'm giving. So, okay, this this is what we've done, right? My wife and I, we developed four pillars that we live our life off of because we want to feel successful. So success to us is not, like we were saying, just a destination. It's a feeling. And one time we were dirt broke. Like, we had $84 in our bank account, about to get on food stamps, had no idea what we were about to do. Luckily, Nike called, gave me an advance. I could pay rent. And we sat down and said, okay, what is that? What are the things that we need in order to feel successful and fulfilled in life? And we identified our four pillars. And our four pillars are live, give, save, and travel. So we live a happy and healthy life. We give 10% of our income away to good causes. We travel to see what else is out there. And we save for tomorrow. So we do all four of those things every day. And when you do that, you're living and you're feeling successful. So what I recommend is setting up those pillars with yourself or with your partner and live a successful life. Don't aim to be successful, if that makes sense.
Well, I want to talk about something that kind of goes along with that and plays off of it and probably to you is very closely related. And that's also one of the secrets of the billionaire, of Red McCombs, that you learned from him in this article. You said the best time is now.
Yeah.
And this is something that I always struggle with. It's in the exact quote that you quoted from him was, it's not about picking the right thing. It's about picking something and doing it right. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people struggle between, well, what is the right thing? Or, you know, that whole concept of, well, I can pick anything. As long as I do that right, then I'm doing okay. Mm-hmm. Where does that balance come in? How do you kind of explain that more in layman's terms?
Well, what Red was saying is, if you focus on producing quality and doing it right, you'll always win. So don't focus on necessarily what it is you want to do, but focus on how you will do it. So one of the things that I teach is practice how you play, or how you practice is how you will play, right? So don't think about, oh man, do I want to be a writer? Do I want to be a speaker? Do I want to go and get a leadership job at a nonprofit or a corporation? Focus more on writing the best book that you can and doing it right. Focus on speaking in the best area and be the best speaker that you can be, just doing it right. Because what he was saying is, eventually, people are going to mess up and you're going to shine because your clients or your customers or those who do business with you will see that you do it right. So focus on how you do it, not necessarily just what you want to do.
You talk about practicing how you play. Mm-hmm. How many times did you practice, or how many hours did you spend practicing the award-winning speech?
Oh, man. I had 26 versions of that speech. I practiced it. I received over 1,000 evaluations from it. I practiced it hundreds and hundreds of times. I would go in the middle of downtown Portland, Oregon during rush hour. It's called the Pioneer Square, where all the train stops. And I would go in the middle of it and I would give that speech, and people thought I was crazy. They would throw money at me. made a couple dollars here and there.
Pay the rent.
Pay the rent, you know what I'm saying? And I would just practice anywhere. I practice in the gym sauna. I practice underwater because I'm a fast talker and you talk a lot slower with water in your mouth. So I just practice anywhere and everywhere I could, hundreds of times.
Did you ever practice with a bird on it?
No, I never practiced with a bird on it.
That's a 10% joke for any Portlandia fans out there.
That is the first time I've ever been asked that question. Thank you for that.
Yeah, for sure. So what was the hardest part of all those practicing? Because to me, just listening to you describe that, okay, sitting, practicing to myself for a certain amount of time, or in front of the mirror, in front of a camera, any of those things would be great. But actually getting the evaluations, you said you got over 1,000 evaluations, which, you know, if you're in the middle of Pioneer Square, some people might throw a couple dollars at you or something, but no one's really going to sit down and give you a critique. But those evaluations you're getting, sometimes that's got to be really hard to actually face the truth.
Oh, definitely. And I remember this one time I thought it was just the most hysterical speech. I loved it. And I signed up for 4 speeches in one day and no one laughed. And I was just defeated. I was burnt out. I was defeated. People were giving me this feedback and I just could not. I felt like I couldn't even move, just because I was like, how am I going to write a funny speech when I thought I was funny and no one's laughing? So yeah, I think you have to quickly identify the difference between an opinion and feedback. People love to tell you their opinion, but feedback is what you determine to be something that you can use to better resonate with your audience. So when multiple generations, multiple sexual orientations, multiple religions, multiple both genders are telling you something and it's consistent, that's when you need to take a look at it. That is good feedback. But until then, those are just opinions here and there that is hard to weed out. That's why it's important to practice, 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 get all those different evaluations to see how well you're doing and how consistent your message is.
Well, you, the video of your speech, I watched it a couple times, actually. It's very entertaining. Obviously, you said you beat over 30,000 people through the course of that process to win that championship.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is the physical aspect. It's not just the talking. But I thought it was really funny. So have you ever considered any kind of stand-up or comedian type stuff? Because, I mean, to be honest, a lot of the comedians you see, they stand up there with their hands in their pockets and they say funny things.
Yeah.
But none of them have really mastered that element of the physical comedy to go along with it, and you've got it nailed.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I tried stand up 2 years ago before I even spoke, and again, no one laughed. And that was the last time I did stand up for me. One of the things that I think is really important to get out there too, and for the listeners, the other about 6 months ago, I got this feedback. Well, it wasn't even feedback. So when I give speeches, I pass out workbooks, and on the back of them is a testimonial form. Well, a testimonial means something that you can use for promotional materials and something I could put on my website. Well, this one woman, she said, "Ryan, you're too feminine on stage. Man up." And I was like, what? But at that time, it really bothered me. And I don't know if anyone's ever received feedback before that just like stops you in your track or it tries to change you. And I remember going out on stage a couple times after that, and I got my voice a little deeper, and I didn't. I moved my hands more manlier. I don't even know what that means, but I...
You made fists instead of open palms.
Yeah. And then I realized, like, that is so stupid. That is not me. I am a feminine male. Like, I use my hands, and I'm all over the place. That is me. So whenever you're speaking, whenever you're delivering a message, be you. And you know what? Just be you on stage, be you off stage. I think it's so important to live your life the way that you want to live it. Eleanor Roosevelt said it best when she said, "Do what you love because people are going to criticize you anyways." And for me, I am this, I'm all over the place. My facial expressions are different. Like right now, if you could see me, my hands are all over the place. I'm talking it's just everywhere. So be you. And I think that's just part of who I am with using my body language like that.
So after you went and tried to do stand-up comic work and no one laughed, why would you try and get on stage and tell jokes again?
Well, for me, it's not about telling jokes. What I tell people is never tell a joke again, only share a failure. And failures can be funny, but what failures do is they connect with your audience, and they also usually prove a point and send a message. So in that speech, I'm never giving a joke. I'm only sharing failures with you that you laugh at, which is great. I wanted you to laugh. but that was the point of that speech, was to deliver a message. And part of that, when you're delivering it, is to add humor. So when that was several years ago when I did that, and I didn't know that at the time. I was just trying to give jokes, and I was like, not for me. This is not for me.
How important is that comedic element in giving a talk? Because I mean people, they give talks at their work, and sometimes they may feel that, hey, it may not be appropriate to be joking around while the boss is there while giving a talk. How important is that comedic element?
I think for most speeches, humor is important. I was just watching a TED talk of why humor can be important, because it releases a chemical inside your brain that helps you build your memory around it. So actually, when you are making people laugh, you're helping them remember what it is that you're saying, which as speakers is really important. But for me, I think it's just like you said, knowing when it is appropriate and when it is not to use humor. But I think in most cases, even when you're giving an obituary, you're giving that speech when someone has passed away, or when someone is leaving work who's been there for 10 years and they have to be let go, I think adding humor can be a great opportunity to bring people together and, like that guy was saying on the TED Talk, help remember what it is that you're saying.
So we've talked a little bit about humor here and how important that is and how it can trigger something in the brain to help memory. But you ended your speech, the award-winning one, on a more emotional note, almost brought tears to your eyes, had mm-hmm. you choked up at the end there. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like a completely opposite. You had people laughing and then you had people crying. Is that equally as important, or was that just a specific circumstance to that talk?
100%. You want to include what I like to call emotional texture. And that's what I talk a lot about in our new book with Jeremy Donovan, is what people think. They think, oh, I want to make people cry and I want to make people laugh. Well, that's great. However, there are six basic emotions that you want to touch up on. That's disgust, that's anger, that's fearful, that's sadness, that's happiness, and that's frightened. So being able to get all six of those basic emotions out there, you will be able to take your audience on a roller coaster, and that's what you want to do. The common mistake that most speakers make is they either take you on an escalator, so they tell you this wonderful story and you're left up in the clouds and life is great. Well, life isn't like that. Or they take you down the basement where they just tell you this really depressing story and they leave you down there and you go, well, that was depressing. Or they take you, the really good speakers take you on a roller coaster. They take you up, they take you down, they have twists, they have turns, but they bring you right back to where you started. And it was a roller coaster ride. It was wonderful, but you're able to go now on your way and you feel satisfied with that ride.
So when you're putting together a talk, since you talked about a roller coaster, do you start with, okay, here's everything I'm going to cover, and then you start arranging it into pieces where it's a up and down type talk where it's highs and lows and whatnot?
What I do is I first identify what message I want to deliver. So I want to deliver the world championship speech. It's called Trust is a Must. I want to let people know that trust is the most important part of any relationship. Okay, now how can I deliver that? Well, there are three stories that I can share. A time when I lied, a time when I was lied to, and a time when I discovered that lying was no longer going to be part of my life, which should never be part of your life. So then I just share those three stories, and then I build off of those three stories to build that emotional texture in there, and the ups and the downs, the twists and the turns, the points, the transitions. That's what I do.
Okay, so you start with the overall picture and then you arrange the pieces. Is that correct?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. So when you, I guess, when you go to different places and you give the same talk, mm-hmm. how are you arranging it differently? Because if the audience is different, you're going to have to arrange it a little differently, right?
You mean if, like, I'm speaking to college students versus business executives?
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely. Yeah. You just have to make sure that you relate to your audience in a way that they can understand it. I would say 90% of my content is the same, but how I build that connection with them is different. So I might share the same story, but I might tell it differently or position it differently. For example, if I'm talking to college students and I'm telling them a story about a time when I almost got arrested when I was in college. Yes, that happened. Sorry, Mom. Please don't listen to this. Sorry for bringing up bad memories. I might say things like, you know, when you're in college, this doesn't happen. Or I might just do, when I'm talking to the executives, say something like, hey, you remember when we were in college? We had a lot. You know, that one little sentence can build that connection, but it's the same story and brings back memories for both audiences.
Well, we're getting a little long in the tooth here, but before we wrap up, I really wanted to touch on something, and you actually just touched on it as well in your article about Red. He kind of brought it up, and it's this whole idea of family and how mm-hmm. that he puts a lot of his success towards the family, and you do as well. And Red's point was, don't call me at home.
he
works, you know, probably crazy hours when he's in the office. He's in there, you know, 6, sometimes 7 days a week. But when he's not in the office, there's a reason he's not in the office. That's because he's got his family time or his personal time. Mm-hmm. And that's very important. So mm-hmm. that's kind of his way of describing his family. And then you, I've heard you talk about your upbringing and how you always, you know, had dinner around the table and all these things. Mm-hmm. And family is just so huge to you. But, you know, in real life, I come across a lot of people that didn't have those same upbringings, don't have either those same values instilled in them, or they don't have those things to lean on. Mm-hmm. And when you're working with other people, how do you kind of impart those values and that wisdom on them that you learned that maybe they didn't have those experiences of, you know, coming to?
I was working with a client a couple months ago, and my belief is you always have to leave your family on a high. You always have to leave them on a pedestal. You can pick at them, you can make fun of them. One of the things that I work with my clients are, if you want to build a relatable story, use your family, because no matter what generation, sexual orientation, religion, people all have families and they can relate to it, whether it's good or bad. And this one woman, she hated her mom. And she was like, I absolutely will not talk about my mom in a positive light. I'm not going to do it. And what I was telling her is, okay, I understand that you had a bad experience with your family. And I'm sorry about that. That is unfortunate. But your mother taught you the ways you didn't want to be a mom to your children. So she still taught you something, and she instilled, your children now are better because of the way that your mom was a bad mom. You are a better mom because of that. And that's how you can instill to say, look, I'm a better mom because how my mom raised me to raise my kids. So I think for me, you just always have, there's nothing absolutely, if you are not successful at home, you will not be successful in life. You have to focus on yourself first, then your family, then your career. And for me, family is the utmost, the only thing that matters. Without family, you got nothing. And if for those of you who out there who feel like you don't like your family or you had a horrible upbringing, you can create your own family, or surround yourself with those friends that are like family. Put yourself, or you become who you surround yourself with. So surround yourself with those people that you consider to be family. We all know that blood doesn't make you family. I mean, I have several adopted friends. My aunt is adopted. And I think for me, I wouldn't consider her anything different than family. So what family is support, is trust, is love, unconditional love. And for me, I'm not doing anything without family.
You're such a glass is half full kind of guy. What do you attribute, I mean, besides the family, just on a day-to-day basis, what really keeps you motivated and keeps you so upbeat?
I think that one day I know that I'll be gone. I think that I know that's really deep, but I wake up every day and I say, today is my day. I don't know if I have tomorrow. Like, I love life and I get to experience it. And I have been blessed with the opportunity to experience it in ways that other people won't. And to know that you're going to go means you got to live every day to the fullest. I'm interviewing a Holocaust survivor next week, and I'm reading his autobiography. And he's just talking about being in this concentration camp for 3 years, never seeing a vegetable, never having pockets, seeing a shower head and not being able to not think about his entire family being annihilated in the Holocaust. And I think about those stories, or I read those books, and I think about, wow, our life here is so phenomenal. Like, you just have to live life. There is so many things to be thankful for and to be happy about. You just got to focus on those.
Well, I've heard people say, hey, if you read like this sad stuff, like if you watch the news and all they talk about is sad stuff, or if you read books and it's all about sad stuff, it's just going to make you think negatively. But you say it's doing the opposite thing.
Meaning like focus on the positive and you'll...
Yeah, well, like you're reading about the Holocaust. I mean, that's one of the worst tragedies ever. And you're putting a positive spin on it when most people, they would just kind of go in like a mini depression in their mind just thinking about it.
I think that's a good point. I think for some instances, I agree with you. And then some instances I can see where I don't watch the news. I don't wake up to reading the New York Times. I read books like you, Joe, like Think and Grow Rich and Grown Up Digital, and books that will help me and help the people that I work with. I think those stories then in the news, like for example, right now, the Malaysian airline, I think that's a horrible tragedy, and those are good for current events. But if you get consumed by those and you're off balance by that being the only thing you're digesting, it can be negative.
Okay. Well, just last question to stick on the family. I mean, since Dan and I were both married and you have Chelsea, you have these big goals. Does that kind of, and they're, I mean, they take a lot of your time. Does that kind of overshadow some of her goals as well?
This is something that we talk about a lot because I have this weird, crazy gobstopper energy and drive. And I'm like, let's do this. And that might be very similar with a lot of other couples. So I have to make sure that I'm constantly saying, Chelsea, babe, what is it that you want to accomplish? What can I help you with? What is it that you want to do? And being open to hearing that, making sure that I, as a man, am not only providing for Chelsea, but together we're partners, right? So we provide for each other, but I'm not overshadowing. It's a 50-50 relationship. So making sure she is feeling satisfied, I'm feeling satisfied. We're both bringing things to the table. We've realized that several of my goals can help her goals and make her dreams come true. We've identified what it is that she needs to be and feel successful, and making sure that we're living our life around those as well. Because we have, I think it's important to be a couple, but then be individuals. So we've identified, you know, our four pillars of what we need. But what does she need on a professional level? And what do I need on a professional level? So just constantly being open and communicating. I'm a very loud person, not just loud in general, but I take up a lot of space because I'm one of those extroverted guys and she's introverted. So I have to just step back and make sure, okay, am I taking up a lot of space? Making sure there's plenty of room for both of us up here. So we're actually looking at developing some products and even coaching together, which I'm excited about.
Love it. Well, we know you have a huge busy schedule coming up. Tell the listeners what you got coming up in the next couple months.
Well, I want everyone to participate in the Guinness Book of World Record for the largest book signing in history. You can sign up at ryanavery.com. You pre-register for the event. It will be live stream all around the world. You can buy it online, still participate. I will sign it, ship it your way, and together we will break history. So I really want people to pre-register for that event, and let's break a world record together on Wednesday, April 16th. I have a book tour coming out in April and May, and my book that's co-written by best-selling author Jeremy Donovan. It's called Speaker, Leader, Champion, Succeed at Work Through the Power of Public Speaking, that I really recommend you pick up. But just stay in touch. RyanAvery.com. I'm posting blog articles every week. I'm not great like you two with a podcast, but I'm doing the old-fashioned writing the blog articles. And yeah, that's what's coming up with me.
That's surprising because you love to talk and you don't have a podcast.
I know. Jared has pushed me into doing one in Q3 and Q4 of this year. So we're looking at doing one in our strategy plan, starting it in Q4.
Perfect. Well, Ryan, thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
Definitely. Thank y'all.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'd love it if you join us every Monday morning to hear the latest episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown podcast. Remember, the place to go to find the show notes of today's episode and a whole lot more is www.entrepreneurshowdown.com. And while you're there, leave us your email address to find out about upcoming guests, latest episode releases, and a whole lot more.